Do you feel heard? Do you know how to truly use your voice and speak up? Or are you so used to being silenced that you stop your thoughts before the words can even reach your tongue? So many of us fear the consequence of speaking up after far too many instances of being punished for daring to tell the truth, take up space, and speak. If any of this resonates, that ends today. Today's guest has the tools to help you unlearn silence and find your true voice. Welcome to Unleash Your Inner Creative with Lauren LaGrasso. I'm Lauren LaGrasso. I'm an award-winning podcast host, producer, singer-songwriter, public speaker, and multi-passionate creative. And this show is meant to give you tools to love, trust, and know yourself enough to claim your right to creativity and pursue whatever it is that's on your heart. Today's guest is Elaine Lynn Herring. She's a facilitator, speaker, lawyer, and writer. Elaine works with organizations and individuals to build skills in communication, collaboration, and conflict management. She's worked on 6 continents and with a wide range of corporate, government, and nonprofit clients. She's also a former lecturer on law at Harvard Law School, thank you very much, specializing in dispute resolution, mediation, and negotiation. Her new book, Unlearning Silence, which comes out Tuesday, March 19th, is all about the dangers of silence, how to find your voice, and make sure that you do your part to never silence another person. Elaine is truly the perfect guest for the show, as we all could use tools to help us speak up, better define our voices, and express ourselves clearly. Her tools will help you unleash and step toward your most authentic and creative self. From today's chat, you'll learn the different forms of silence and how to spot them in yourself and others, the power of speaking up, how to find your voice, start to use your voice, and much more. Okay, now here she is, Elaine Lynn Herring. Obviously, we're going to talk a lot about the book. I'm super, super excited, and just silence in general. But is there anything else like that you really want to hit today? Like anything you're super passionate about talking about right now, specifically within the context of silence?
The message is we all have so much to offer this world.
Yeah.
And the ways that we silence ourselves, that we internalize the messages from people around us, that, you know, the ways that people continue to silence us, all diminishes that. And I really just want people to live full lives. Like, I want people to love themselves and be excited and not edit themselves and not think that their ideas are stupid because someone else told them that or they fear it.
Right.
I love that you're sitting in a lip chair. So maybe that's right.
That's what the show's all about. So you're in the right place. Yeah. It's just, that's why I really wanted to have you on, because I fully believe if we all did that, we would be living in a much more peaceful, vibrant, loving place. Yeah. And I believe like self-love, self-knowledge, and self-trust are the keys to pretty much everything. So, and that's what I heard throughout everything.
Yeah. Too. My question is, you know, I have some assumptions given the name of your podcast and also what I found online, but tell me about your audience. What do they listen in for? What are you hoping they get out of it so I can be speaking to that?
So it's about unleashing creativity through the lens of self-development and healing. So your book is really dead on for that. Like, I think it's really important to talk about the ways that we've been silenced by others, the ways we've silenced ourselves, and also, as you so brilliantly talk about in the book, the ways we silence others. If you're always thinking of yourself as the victim, it's very hard to see when you're actually even low-level victimizing others. So I think that's really important, because so many times people have been victimized and then they just turn around and victimize other people. And so anyway, I want to talk to people about how to find their voice and how to encourage others to find their voices. Because I think if we could all do this, as is your point, the world would be a much more healed place.
Amazing. And so when I read inner creative, it's not just people who are creating, even though we all do that. It is an identity. It is a whole person.
Right. My theory is everyone is creative. I think it's our birthright.
As someone who had a lot of my creativity like beat out of me as a kid, because it wasn't good enough, because it wasn't perfect, because it wasn't practical. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that. Elaine, I already feel like we're sisters. I guess we should dive in, because I want to talk about that. That's something that on the show, I've really come to understand. Like, the reason I host a show called Unleash Your Inner Creative is because I felt like I needed permission to unleash mine. And I believe we teach what we most need to learn, and that that is actually what we're best to teach, because what are we going to teach it to, like, somebody who has an intuitive understanding should be teaching how to unleash their creativity or how to find your voice? No, the people who worked hard to figure that out are the ones that need to teach it because they have the tools. So I'm so excited to talk to you today.
The phrase that comes to mind is something that someone said to me years ago, and I've hung on to: your greatest pain becomes your greatest ministry.
Mm.
Your greatest gift to the world comes from what you had to work through, what you had to heal from.
So will you tell me a little bit about your silence story? Why is this topic the most important one to you? Why is this what you have made your life around?
You know, I didn't start my life out thinking about this, obviously. I went to law school intending to be a litigator. I came across negotiation theory and pedagogy at the Harvard Negotiation Project. I thought, wait, we're allowed to talk about things? What a novel idea, right? I came from a family where we didn't talk about things. Turns out, apparently, my family's not the only one. We swept things under the rug. We kept up appearances. We saved face. That was normal. And so I learned a very expensive lesson going to Harvard Law School that, oh, you can talk about things. Emotions, those are normal. They have important data. And so I threw myself into this path of personal growth, but also, turns out, it's called leadership development in corporate spaces. Did that for 10 years, teaching other people's ideas about negotiation, difficult conversations, giving and receiving feedback. All of that, I think, is really helpful. And I started to notice that despite paying a lot of money, spending a lot of time, some people after the training, after the workshop, still didn't negotiate, still didn't have the difficult conversations. Why is that? And there was also a bunch of conversation of, if you're not having the difficult conversation, well, essentially, you just got to do it. Just speak up.
Yeah. I love it when people say that. Like, just do it. Like, sorry, Nike, but that doesn't work.
Well, it doesn't even work at Nike. It's a great marketing tagline, but it doesn't work. So what does work? Why don't we speak up?
Yeah,
is the question I started to ask. And what I landed on and discovered is we've all learned silence. We've learned when and where it's appropriate for us to say something. And we learn that based on people's reactions to us over time, right? Sometimes people didn't have to tell us to shut up. They just shot us that look.
Mm.
Whether it was your mom, whether it was your teacher, whether it was a colleague, you said something and they just gave you the look. And the message you learned from that was, my thought is not worthy. It is not useful. It is not valuable. And therefore, the danger is sometimes it becomes a message of, I am not worthy. I am not valuable. And so we learn to stay silent as a matter sometimes of self-care and of survival. So I'm not really answering your question because I'm going into the story. But that's how I came to silence as an idea and thought, look, if the root cause of why we don't speak up, why we don't negotiate, why we don't have these conversations is silence that we have learned, well, we can unlearn it. And it's actually not just about the silence I have learned, because the silence I have learned is all interconnected to the people around me, the people who continue to silence me, the people who say, I really want to hear what you have to think, but when I share it, tell me that I'm wrong. So if we really want to solve for silence, if we want to live more fully, if we want to unleash the creative in us, we need to solve for silence in our lives, in our relationships, and in our communities.
Ooh, so much to break down from what you just said. So you bring up many examples in the book, but like, I believe that our purpose is the midpoint between our greatest joy and our greatest suffering. And to me, I mean, I'm sure you have many purposes. In reading this book, it's clear that part of your purpose is helping people find their voice. What are those midpoints for you? Like, what was your greatest pain and your greatest suffering as it relates to helping people find their voice? I mean, greatest pain and greatest joy.
Yeah. Let me start with joy, because we all need a little bit more joy in our lives. My greatest joy is the opportunity in talking with people to say, you know what? You weren't crazy.
Mm.
It wasn't you. And for people to feel seen, known, and heard in their humanity as they are, appreciated, loved, not because of what they can do or how they can show up, but because by nature of being human, you are worthy of being seen as human. Okay, so why might people not feel seen and heard? Because when we continue to dole out the advice, just speak up, it essentially boils down to you're the problem. If you can't speak up, then you're the problem. Go fix yourself. Be more direct, be more clear, talk in a lower voice, some version of fix yourself. My favorite, by the way, is show less emotion. But if that's what we've been told, that's what we've internalized, then A, it feels really gross inside, but B, it's just false and inaccurate. So the greatest joy is being able to say, you know what? It's not you. It's not because you're deficient. It's this thing called silence. Now, if we've learned it, let's interrogate it and decide what of that served us in the past. What of that we want to keep? What assumptions we want to take going forward to become the people we want to be? That is the greatest joy and honor. The greatest pain, unironically, I can't speak about in detail because I've signed a non-disclosure agreement and a non-disparagement clause because we have silencing mechanisms.
I've signed a few of those in my day, Elaine, before I knew what I was doing.
If we want to talk about the systemic piece, and I'll say, even if we do know what we're doing, it may make sense for you to sign the clause because you can't fight it anymore, because you need to be able to move on. Everyone says that writing a book turns you inside out and upside down, and I would say writing a book on unlearning silence while trying to unlearn my own silence is just next level. That is the greatest pain that any of us have to go through, all of this. To be diminished and not seen in our full humanity, and to have to spend time recovering from it. So bridging that real life experience with the joy and the opportunity of doing something good and healing, that's where I find myself and moving more toward this direction. But I chuckled because when I started writing this book, it was very much a professional endeavor, right? I'd been teaching this stuff. All right, we need new content. I think there's something useful here. The book sold at auction. People were interested in it. And a friend of mine said, you know, I'm so excited for you and I can't wait to celebrate with you and grieve with you. And I thought, grieve with me? What is that all about? Turns out there's a lot of grief in it. There's a lot of pain in it. But if we can name our pain, discuss it, share it, and all of us realize we're not alone in it, there is healing and community and hope for a different future in that. And that's what this book is about.
I'm just holding you with so much love because it's excruciating to learn how to use your voice fully and not be able to do it fully. Like, you know how to do it, but you can't.
Well, let me take a step back, even further back, which is, I think we start to doubt whether we have a voice at all. Because if you are only rewarded for saying the things that other people want to hear, if you are only accepted in the relationship or in the work team, having a seat at the table, if you're conforming, then do you really have a voice at all? I'd argue that we do, but there is definitely a rediscovering my voice. Right? We were all born as babies with voices. It came in the form of crying. Whatever we needed, we knew how to unabashedly advocate for ourselves. And over time, in the name of propriety, in the name of professionalism, we tamp all of that down. That's not to say that there isn't wisdom in choosing when we speak and what we share, reading the room. But could we be more free in that and create spaces where other people can be more free in that?
I think definitely yes. I want to get into so many different things, but before we go any further, can we just, for the purpose of this conversation, define what is silence? How do you define silence?
I love a good definition. This is the lawyer in me coming out, right? And it's such a good question because some people are like, well, don't we need more silence in this world? We need it for meditation and mindfulness. Absolutely. Silence to me is when there's not enough room in the conversation for you. Everyone else has sucked all the energy out of the room. There's no space for your preferences, your needs, your thoughts. It's when you weren't invited to the meeting. You couldn't ask to be invited. It's having to edit out parts of yourself because they're deemed unacceptable. That's the silence we're talking about.
And you spoke about the workplace. And you work with, I know you have worked with so many different workplaces and done trainings, and you still do it. I feel like even with people's best intentions, so many weird, crunchy mechanisms end up getting put into place that make people weird, crunchy people.
Yes. The non-crunchy places that don't crunch people are what I would call the unlearning silence culture. Mm. You have built a culture of voice. And I've got an assessment with a bunch of different dimensions, but essentially looking at different behaviors and practices, the level of psychological safety. I know that that's such a buzzword, but how do you really bring psychological safety to life? Do people feel like they can say what they think and feel without consequence? Is there clarity in who makes the decision? If we look at our policies and our practices, have we audited them to look at which demographics, which people do these policies support, which do they silence? I, and I think everyone else, is so tired of talking about return to office, whether we're going to do it. But the one thing I will say is return to office was such a lightning rod topic because of who it silences and who it supports, who we're making incur the cost of go into the office, the impact on families or caregiving responsibilities, of flexibility, and also to acknowledge it's fundamentally a different skill set to lead and manage remotely. So you're actually supporting and centering old habits of people who knew how to lead and manage in person rather than the different skill set of remote leadership or management. Who are you supporting with your policy decision? Who are you silencing? And are you being intellectually honest about the impacts? There are places that we can all continue to make healthier by our individual choices and the ways that our choices impact each other and our willingness to engage and push for policy changes and also alignment between policy and practice. And now I just sound like a policy wonk, but we'll let that hang.
But it's true. I mean, you know, it's like you can try all day and I do think that you can lead from wherever you are, but at a certain point, the power you have is the power you have, and the system has to change in order for things to entirely change.
Completely. And you get to decide what role you want to play in that. The trap so many of us fall into is we take it as a personal failing when we can't get that policy change through. And we internalize that as our personal failing versus change is going to require each of us, but is not up solely to any one of us. So as I make my choices of how I spend my time and energy, what am I fighting for today? How do I want to use my voice? And voice not just being the words that I say, but how I move through the world.
What does leadership that empowers someone finding and honing their voice look like?
That there is room for difference. An appreciation for difference. We can coexist. We can see the value of the different perspectives of wiring. And so when I say difference, one of the key skill sets of leadership that is healthy is, can I listen across difference? And I don't just mean hear people when they disagree with me. I mean, can you hear me if I'm not speaking to you in your preferred tone, time, way? If in workplaces, we'll go back to unhealthy workplaces. Unhealthy workplaces require people to speak in three succinct bullet points with no ums and show enough emotion that you show you care, but not enough emotion that you lose your credibility. For example, right? We've never been in a workplace like that.
Never.
There's a very narrow definition of what is effective or what a leader looks like. And we spend all this time trying to fit into that model of leadership versus, hey, you speak with some ums? Cool. Can I hear the heart of what you're saying? Because in what you're saying, even if there are some ums or even if you tear up, there's a gem. And as your leader, I want to honor that and check to make sure I've gotten it. And if you think better, you operate better, as a post-processor, meaning you don't quite figure out what you want to say in the meeting, but after the meeting, 20 minutes later, you're like, that's the gem. I want you to circle back and put it in Messenger to me, because I don't want to lose out on that brilliant insight you had just because you didn't say it real time in a meeting. That leadership that affords the difference and appreciates the difference and can leverage it, that's healthy.
Yeah, that was something I wanted to ask you about, because I think, you know, in reading your book, I was thinking about all the times I had been silenced, but also doing my best to review the times when I have maybe silenced somebody else, whether it's in a professional setting or even in my relationship. Like, what are the times I assumed I knew more? I didn't fully listen to someone. I cut them off. And it can be haunting to remember these times. Is there like an expiration date on when you can do the circle back and be like, hey, you said this thing. When should you leave it alone? Like, when is it helpful? When is it not?
I would argue there is no statute of limitations on when you can circle back. Because if you still remember it, they probably remember it too. And it's a question of who's going to raise it. Probably not them, if they felt injured by it. I would also ask the question, why do I want to circle back? What am I looking for? Checking your own motivations, mostly for yourself. What battles do you want to fight today? What do you have energy for? Because there is sort of circling back to that person, apologizing, owning it to say, hey, I saw that, I see it, and I want to do differently, can be really powerful. Some of us, if we've lost people in our lives, we may not have the opportunity to circle back. And it's really a question then of, for what purpose? Because you can move forward and change going forward as well without necessarily circling back. So I'd argue there's no expiration date. And for what purpose would you go there? I will say I circled back after about 5 years to someone and said, hey, do you remember that moment? And they're like, yep. And I was like, oh, okay, it really was that bad. And I really want to apologize. I should have done better. I wish I had shown up better. And I'm really sorry. You know, it was about like a 20-second conversation. And they're like, I really appreciate that. And then we moved on. I'm glad I did it.
And on the other side, I find myself really angry at a lot of the times I was silenced. I find myself angry at myself that I didn't say more. Like, there's just like moments I feel like I was robbed of because I didn't feel like I could speak up, or I took on the shame or the guilt someone was putting on me.
Yeah.
I find myself like mad at the times when I was just speechless that you described in the book. What do you do with that? Like, how do you know whether it's worth it to circle back with someone who has silenced you, or if you just need to find a way to move on?
Let me ground us in a fundamental principle of silence, which is the difference between silence that is additive or oppressive is agency. Is it silence that is chosen for you or that you're choosing for yourself? Because silence, not talking about it, not revisiting it, can be an act of self-care. I just do not have it in me to take this on, to open up the wound. It's finally become a scar. And if I open up the wound, right? Wounds are a place of pain. Scars are a source of strength. So my question would be, can you get to that scarred place, let the scar tissue form, or is going back to it actually necessary or helpful for letting that scar tissue form? And I think only you know that, right? It so depends on the relationship and the context. The other place I'd go is self-compassion. We're all imperfect people. The reasons that you didn't speak up in the moments that you wish you could replay, you were a different person then that you are now. And even if you're like, no, I'm not, I am still just that way, we still have the opportunity to choose going forward. So what do I want to do tomorrow? Because yesterday and today don't have to predict tomorrow. Totally happy to go into a live case study if there's a story you want to share. And I'd ground us in, it really depends. And I would let you guide that for yourself of, why might I want to revisit? What am I hoping to get out of it? What can I control? Because you can't control the other person's response. And many of us have tried and tried and tried. And so what's a healthy boundary for yourself that allows you to get to that source of strength going forward?
Yeah. I think in these couple instances I'm thinking of, it's for sure self-care. It's not like it's, you know, my mom, who there was a moment with, who I actually have the heartbeat of the relationship is beautiful. And she just missed me in a moment. It's like people I don't feel safe with. So I think I need to find a way to just let it go on my own. But it was something that was interesting as I was reading. And I also had this thought in my head, and I'm curious where you stand on it. Do you think silence is at the center of all trauma?
As a lawyer, I feel the need to give you some caveats.
Love it.
I am not a psychiatrist. I am not a medical professional. I am not a psychologist. My layperson's instinct is yes. Silence is fundamentally a trauma response. Being silenced, not respected, not being seen, not being heard, having to withhold part of yourself. Based on what I know about trauma as a layperson, yeah.
And then I also wondered, I'm a musician outside of this, and I'm writing a lot about family secrets and secrecy right now. And I was thinking about that a lot when I was reading this. I mean, there's so many things within a family culture that you just stay quiet about. I'm 100% Italian, and in Italian culture as well, it's very much about like protect the family, make the family look good, don't let outsiders in to see the cracks in the foundation. And, you know, there was abuse in my family. Like my grandmother was horribly abused, and it's still not like openly talked about in our family. And I just said to my mom, like, who are we protecting at this point? Like, are we whispering for the dead? How does this silence piece come into play in the culture of families and secrecy?
Let's breathe through that one, because our families so influence us. I come from a family, as I mentioned when we started this conversation, that we didn't talk about things. And there's something about immigration and living through world wars that our generations that came before us didn't talk about it. And we also know that we continue to carry trauma in our bodies, and it is passed down generation to generation. To me, the question is, our generation, what do we want to do about it? Who does my silence serve? Who does my silence protect? Who does my silence harm? I'd answer those questions for ourselves, because whether or not we talk about it, it's there. It's in our bones, it's in our bodies, it's in our reactions, and we also have the opportunity to choose a different way. I've had so many conversations in my own family and the family I married into of, if you had just told me, we would have made such different life decisions. It fundamentally would have changed the course of history and would have prevented further pain. And so what do I want to do? I want to break that cycle for my kid and the generations that come after me. There's no blame or judgment of the abuse that happened, right? Hurt people hurt people. But can we heal ourselves so we don't keep hurting other people?
Whew. There's a loneliness in being the first one to step out of line. How do you work through that?
Unlearning silence is not a solo sport. It is a team effort. When you were talking earlier about your mom and certain conversations and opinions, I was thinking one of the things that I talk about in the book that I also try to take my own advice is making that list, right? Whose voices are essential in your life? This idea came from when my husband and I got married and we were trying to do the wedding guest thing. And there's just like 17 different people's schedules that we were trying to coordinate. And that was just our wedding party. And so we made a list of who's essential. Who are we willing to schedule our lives around? And if they're not on the list, then we're not going to move the wedding for them. And so that's what we did. And then a dear friend and colleague of mine said, oh, I can't make it. And I went, oh. But she wasn't on the list. Right? Having that clarity and intentionality of which voices am I going to listen to and what weight am I going to give them in my life? And also, how do I need to supplement the balance of the voices in my life? And by voices, it could be a good friend. It could be a podcast, like I got to listen to Unleash Your Inner Creative every week to get like my dose. It is not a solo sport. So yes, there is loneliness in stepping out of line. But there's also loneliness in staying in line.
So much. That was one of my favorite things you said in the book. How do I reconcile what I believe with what I've been taught? And I think that's a question so many of us don't bother to ask ourselves. You know, what is the difference between my voice and the voice of others that has been repurposed as my own?
Totally. And how disorienting is that? You know, I had a moment of, shoot, I'm a grown-ass woman and I don't know what I think. And that is deeply disorienting. And I just want to go stare at Netflix to like balm to my soul. It's going to be okay and calm my nervous system. But if I think about the life I want to live, one full of meaning and intentional impact to shape the world in the ways that I think are more towards the ones that I'd want to see, I've got to start questioning and reckoning and choosing for myself rather than going on autopilot. It's not easy work. None of this is easy work. I'm also a firm believer that living intentionally the life that you want and the life that you want to lead, that is worth it for breaking the cycles that come and also the flow-on impact that you have for the people around you.
One of your main purposes in this book is helping people find their voice. If there is somebody listening who has a lot of learned silence, how do they start to unwind that and find their voice?
Yeah. Step one, start with self-compassion. There's usually a first step of blame, like my, oh shoot, I'm a grown-ass woman. Shame, guilt, throw it on, toss it on. Just jump over that if you can. It just means you're human.
I love the visual.
I'm not a high jumper, a long jumper, whatever it is. You're just human. And also the things that we learned from our parents, our ancestors, like everyone did their best. I want to believe that. And it's our responsibility to decide what do we take going forward. Now, very tactically, what do you do as you're listening to any meeting, any conversation, any podcast, reading, watching anything? Ask yourself, what do I think? What do I really feel? What do I need? That's three bonus questions if you really want to start micro, just start with what I think. Because what that does is remind you, you have thoughts of your own. You have your own lens on the world. You have opinions of your own, and it recultivates this idea that you have thoughts that matter. You matter. You can then decide whether you want to share any of those thoughts with people, but it's all internal work, so it is pretty low stakes. But it reminds you that you are a person, a real person in there. And it recultivates. Should I give the next step?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, then start with small experiments. And by small experiments, if you read the book, I talk about asking a cab driver to open the window and my 10-minute internal debate with myself about whether to ask. Right, but that was a calculated small experiment that I thought was pretty low stakes because probably never going to see the guy again. I was eventually going to get out of the car. The worst that he could say is no, right? I'm in a populated area, so I'm relatively safe. And trying it out of asking for something or expressing an opinion to see what happens. Because like the taxi driver actually pushing a button and letting the window come down, often what we find is there is impact. Or even if it's not the impact that I wanted, it didn't kill me. Which it can often feel like our fear sensor is real. So what is a low-cost, low-risk experiment that you could try in expressing an opinion that differs from the majority norm and see what happens? Strangers are great for experimentation.
Yes. I love that. It's what I call microdosing courage.
Totally. Totally.
Yeah. I did that when I was trying to learn to set boundaries. I would like set boundaries with like random people. You know, like the guy in the parking garage who was being mean to me.
Yes. And what did you learn from that?
I learned I didn't die. And actually, like, I asked him a question. I said, why are you mad at me? And then he told me his son was sick and he was going through something. And I was taking it so personally. So it also taught me like, okay, yeah, he's not being nice to me, but it's not about me. And it depersonalized that experience from being like, I must be bad to like, he is in pain.
And that is voice. That is communication rather than the assumptions that we hold about what's going on or people's intentions. But we can't get to that unless there's an exchange. Usually words help.
Yeah. I love that you said in the book, use your words. We can say this to adults too.
It really sucks, though, to have to take your own advice sometimes, right?
Our lizard brains do not. I hate the taste of my own medicine. It's terrible. It tastes like Dimetapp.
But it gets pretty good results.
Yeah, it does. It's effective. You share a template for speaking up. Can we go through that? Because I think it's really important. Because I wrote a question about this. I wrote 4 pages of questions for you, Elaine. Like, we could sit here for years. We'll never get through them all. But one of them I wrote, like, and you just described, is why does it feel like we're going to die? I literally sometimes think my brain thinks I'm going to die if I speak up.
We're laughing about it, but actually it's no laughing matter. Right? Yeah. Our bodies are wired, our brains are wired to scan for threat. And one of the most interesting pieces of research is that something that someone says that infringes upon your psychological safety can have far longer lasting impacts than a punch to the face. So no wonder it feels like we're going to die. And to be clear, there are some contexts where people really do die. Or their careers die, or their relationship dies. And so that threat scanner that serves us so well, you know, back in our cave person days, still exists. But the threats come in emails or what people say usually. So it's not unfounded, but it's how do we modulate to understand that there is emotion, but there is also logic. And these anchors that I offer for speaking up actually tap into that. So the first anchor is start with why. And why gets to the emotional brain as well as the logical brain, right? Like, why am I here? Why would I take on the risk of this discomfort, of this feeling that I might die? Oh, because being able to take a stand for justice is worth it to me. Or because I care about someone else behind me not having to go through the same thing, or because I care enough about our intimacy in our relationship that I'm going to take the risk to be vulnerable with you, even though it feels like I'm going to die. So start with why. What is that bigger reason that you would actually use your voice? And if you can anchor to that, then you have a reason to take on the disruption of trying on something new. The second anchor is to connect the dots. And this is one of my favorite stories in the book because the illustration I use is about a dispute I had with my husband about cleaning the toilet.
Toilet gate.
It's an illustration of how we see things differently. And I'll let you read the rest of it in the book. But we all see things differently. What are you seeing? What meaning are you making of it? How do we connect the dots? Because clearly we are not seeing eye to eye and taking the time to understand how are you thinking about it? What do you see? How is that different from what I see? And from that, it's a little bit like your illustration in the parking garage of, oh, I didn't know about your sick family member. This makes more sense to me to be able to contextualize. Third is make your ask clear. When you're speaking up, what are you actually asking them to do? Are you asking them to listen? Are you asking them to empathize? Are you asking them to problem solve? Most of us want to show up well for the other person. We actually just don't know how. So being able to do someone a service to say, you know what, Lauren, like, I just need you to listen today. I am not looking for advice. Or no, I really am looking for advice. So I don't leave the conversation feeling like, well, yeah, she just did like a bunch of empathy, but what I really wanted was tell me what to do. Making that match. So start with why, connect the dots, make the ask clear. And the fourth is embrace resistance. When we speak up, we so want people to just be like, yes, of course, I'm going to change my behavior. I'm going to change the policy. Magic wand, done. And that's not often the response we get. And then we get discouraged and demotivated and think that our speaking up doesn't work. But because we have actually verbalized it, put a stake in the ground, any resistance is engagement. If you talk to salespeople, they'll say, actually, a no. If I got an email response from you, and even if it's a decline, that's still engagement because I can still cultivate that. It's a similar idea to say, look, resistance is normal. So when it comes at you, be like, hi, resistance, there you are. And then figure out how to engage it, what's behind it, what might need to change in order for you to be interested in this idea, to hear me, but to not take it personally. So I offer these 4 anchors rather than here's exactly the words that you use to speak up, because we know that a script doesn't work. But these 4 things are all true. And as we're hit with the waves of discomfort, of resistance, We have something to grab onto.
Hey, creative. If you love the show and it has meant a lot to you, could you do me a favor? Rate and review on Apple, give it a review on Spotify, share it with a friend. These things all make a major difference in a podcaster's life and in growing their show. And I really want to build up this community of creatives who love, trust, and know themselves, and love, trust, and deeply know others. So if you could do that and share the show with someone you care about, that would mean so much. All right, I love you. So what do you do when the resistance feels more like a stonewalling? You know, like let's say you go to your boss at work and you're like, hey, this is too much work for me. I feel like I'm going to absolutely get burnt out. I don't have enough hours left in my work week to complete this. And they say, well, that's just the way it is. You have to do it. We're making cuts. You got to do it.
Or sometimes you make the decision to not even have that conversation.
Right.
Because you're like, they're making cuts. I don't want to be a liability.
Right. I know we can't have a script, but what would be a possible next step there?
Yeah. There's so many different ways we could go with this. One is anchor to something they care about. This is unsustainable. Or what's the flow and effect? What's in it for them? Is it decreased quality in work? All of those things. This is a connecting the dots. They think it must be possible by their conclusion for you to keep sustaining this pace. You have a different perspective, right? Just not going to happen. Where is the disconnect there? You're going back to connecting the spots there. The other is boundaries, taking your advice. What boundary can I set that makes this work for me, emotionally or tactically? The third is a concept I talk in the book that is traditional negotiation of BATNA, best alternative to a negotiated agreement. Because in that instance, so many of us think, this is the only job. This is my only option. I have to put up with it or I will never be employed again. And again, there are so many realities to the job market and very conscious of different waves of layoffs. So that is all data, right? That is in your data set as well. But the mistake that we make as negotiators is that we forget that we have an alternative at all, that there is something else you could do. You could go drive for rideshare. You could go fill in the blank. What could you do if this didn't work out here? And then how do you improve that other option of how you could make money, how you could pay your bills, whatever it is that would be healthier? And to create and improve that option so that you're not assuming this is the only option. Because it's not the only option. It's just the one that's the most familiar and that is right in front of your face.
Yeah. And you talk about a few different biases in the book that cause us to stay silent or to encourage silence. What one do you think is most important for people listening to become aware of so that they can start to use their own voice and encourage others to use theirs?
The present bias. I think we're all pretty short-term people. Using your voice in the moment is deeply uncomfortable, or can be. It gets better as you get used to it, as you build your muscle. I don't want to oversell it, but you know, we were talking about it feels like you're dying. It can feel that way. That's today. What about 30 minutes from now? What about 3 days from now? Because the present bias means that we focus on what is in front of us today, the costs we have to incur today, and we discount the costs that are coming in the future. And we discount what good could come of it because it's unknown and it's down the line. But shoot, I have like sweaty palms and no time today. You know, we're really short-sighted people, but we also have to live with the futures that we create. So I would watch out for that present bias to check, okay, what is true for today, but also what's going to be true down the line if I don't have this conversation now.
Yeah. And I just want to share one thing that I've done recently is kind of like trick myself into thinking it's a less big deal than it feels like. I had to have an uncomfortable conversation. Well, what I thought was going to be an uncomfortable conversation with someone I work with. But then I was in a meeting with them and I'd been like putting it off and putting it off. I'm like, should I email them? Should I text them? Should I call them? I don't know. Oh. And then it was just like the end of the Zoom. And I was just like, I'm just going to be breezy as hell.
Yes.
And just like mention this thing. And the way it was not a big deal, It was like, I was setting a boundary, but it wasn't hard. And they're just like, oh yeah, that totally makes sense. Great. Like, yeah, I totally get why that's your priority. And we'll just have that be the workflow going forward. And I had told myself in my head, they're going to think I'm lazy. They're going to not want me to do it. They're going to just say I need to work harder and do more and more and more. And like, I don't know how I was able to like Jedi mind trick myself in that moment.
Yeah.
But it worked. And so maybe like if you can trick yourself even, maybe it's not trickery. Maybe it's actually like your higher self steps up to the plate and is like, hey, you can do this.
Yes. You're also contextualizing. In the grand scheme of things, is this a huge deal? I think different things work for different people. So I'm really hesitant to do blanket advice, but I love that. I also hear like imaginary theme music coming as you Jedi mind trick. La, la, la. Maybe that's the trick. I call it the mental hacks in the book. One mental hack is, what would I tell my best friend to do? Because so many of us are so much harder on ourselves and less compassionate to ourselves and less willing to advocate for ourselves than we are toward other people. So if this is about self-love and self-care, what would it look like if we held the standard for ourselves that we hold for the people we care most about in life?
Bingo. I think that one is huge. And I really, my sweet little creative cutie listening, want you to rewind and listen to that one more time. Because so much of this is tied to worthiness. Like this was very divine timing, our meeting today, because I literally had a mental breakdown yesterday, Elaine, crying because I'm like, I feel like I stand up for other people so much. Like, you know, I definitely could be better. I'm sure I have had moments where I haven't done the right thing, but I really do try to do the right thing. And I have a track record of putting myself in the way of fire to stand up. I mean, like in high school, I would literally throw myself in the middle of people fighting so that they would stop fighting each other. And it worked.
Yeah.
But I don't do that for myself so often. I have silenced my own voice and allowed myself to be abused and be in situations that weren't good for me. I was like crying, being like, well, why is nobody else speaking up for me in these situations? Like nobody's doing it. And I'm like, you know what? First of all, that's not entirely true. But second of all, like I can always stand up for myself and be the one person in the room who is going to stand up for me if no one else will. It's about, for me right now, like stepping into a new level of worthiness to know that even if it's scary, I deserve to use my voice.
Yes. So I'm going to do a yes and.
Yes and.
There's no caveats on your worthiness. You are worthy as you are. You are worth it as you are. And I think that's in the book because I was like, if no one else has told you this today, because we do not hear it from other people, I want you to hear it from someone. I want you to hear it from me. There is no doubt that you are worthy as you are. And part of unlearning silence is unlearning the ways that we diminish our own needs. Yes, you can absolutely stand up for yourself. You have the capacity, the ability, that mental hack of what would I tell my best friend to do? And unlearning silence is a team sport. So how do we build our teams? That includes, hey, person, if you see me doing A, please do B, right? If you see me telling myself this, tell me that. Here's the aspirational person I want to become. Help me get there. Because there's only so far that like self-discipline, self-control, determination can take us. And there are people around us who want to show up well for us. They may not know, right? We're sitting in that meeting being like, why aren't you saying something? And they're like, I didn't know I could. Because they've also learned silence. And they're like, oh shoot, I want to be more like Lauren. How do I channel that? But if there's a background conversation, an agreement of, hey, Lauren needs me and I know that she needs me and this is how I can help, I'm much more likely to actually do it. So yes, let's advocate for ourselves and let's figure out how to support each other. We're going to go farther, longer, heal faster together.
I love that idea of having a pregame conversation and having a plan. I think that's so important. This part in the book really, really touched me when you talk about how your mentor spoke to you. Can I read it?
Yeah.
Elaine, I like your voice. Your voice is strong. At that moment, tears ran down my cheeks. 30-something years into living on this earth, and it was the first time someone outside of myself acknowledged that I had a voice. And by voice, you now know I don't just mean the timbre of the sound coming out of my mouth. By voice, he meant having my own thoughts, opinions, and preferences, and having them matter. Take me to that moment. Why did that moment mean so much to you, and why do we all need many moments like that?
I didn't know I had a voice. I literally did not know I had a voice. I did not know that I had something to offer, because I thought my value only existed because I was able to do what other people wanted me to do. I was only valuable because I could perform, because I could make someone else's life easier. Now you know why the book is called Unlearning Silence, because I had a lot of unlearning to do, and I continue to unlearn that. But how many of us doubt whether we have a voice of our own, because we've spent so much time solving for everyone else and forgetting that we ourselves matter, which is why we need people like this dear mentor of mine to say, hey, I like your voice. And I'm like, what voice? And to be in that conversation.
It's interesting, because the thing I keep saying, and I'm sure people are sick of hearing me say it, but everything is connected. Everything is the same everywhere. And unlearning silence seems to be also about unlearning utility and unlearning that who we are is what we do, and instead learning that who we are is the best thing about you. You said in that moment you didn't know you had a voice. What do you wish you could say to your younger silent self to help her start sharing her voice?
You matter. You are worthy. Not because of what you can do, but because of who you are.
Elaine, thank you. Thank you for helping us find our voices. And remember, you creative cutie listening, you matter. Thank you for listening, and thanks to my guest, Elaine Lynn Herring. For more info on Elaine, follow her at Elaine Lynn Herring and visit her website, elainelynherring.com, to pre-order a copy of her book, Unlearning Silence, which again releases Tuesday, March 19th. You can also pre-order her book wherever good books are found, so Amazon and all the other places. Thanks to Rachel Fulton for helping edit and associate produce this episode. Follow her at Rachel M. Fulton. Thanks to Liz Full for the show's theme music. Follow her at Liz Full. And again, thank you. If you like what you heard today, remember to rate, review, and follow the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Share the show with a friend and post about it on social media. If you post, tag me at Lauren LaGrasso and at Unleash Your Inner Creative, and I will repost to share my gratitude. Also tag the guests at Elaine Lynn Herring so they can share as well. My wish for you this week is you reflect on the unique and valuable voice that you bring to this world. Your worthiness is about who you are as a person, and your thoughts, opinions, and ideas matter. Stepping out of learned silence and advocating for yourself might not be easy, but once you do it, I promise you, you will feel unstoppable. And honestly, it is one of the quickest ways into self-love and self-trust, and therefore unleashing creatively. I love you, and I believe in you. Talk with you next week.